The world and everything in it is made possible by listeners like us. My name is Molly Bruno. I live in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and I work to spread the good news and make money as an optical engineer. I hope you enjoy today's program.
Good morning. President Biden extends the moratorium on evictions, and his upcoming stimulus package offers more rent assistance. But are these measures necessary?
The fact is we have an economic recovery underway, not because of increased federal funding. We have an economic recovery underway right now because large parts of the country have actually opened up.
Also today, the internal report on the late apologist Ravi Zacharias has been released. We'll talk about that. Plus, the Olasky interview, this one with Christian sociologist Mark Regnerus on the state of Christian marriage around the world.
It's not like they have no relationships. They just don't get really serious about it, and they don't move it to marriage.
And world commentator Janie B. Chaney on the standard of beauty.
It's Tuesday, February 16th. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Mary Reichert.
And I'm Nick Eicher. Good morning.
Time now for the news with Kent Covington.
A massive winter storm is wreaking havoc from Texas to New England. Millions lost power in the Lone Star State on Monday. Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner.
These are not rolling blackouts. These are power outages at a huge, unprecedented scale.
Much of the state is covered in snow all the way down to the beaches of Galveston. President Biden has declared an emergency in Texas and ordered federal assistance. The storm has forced airlines to cancel hundreds of flights in and out of the state. Meantime, residents in parts of Oklahoma lost water service as pipes froze. Jennifer McClintock is with the Oklahoma City Utilities Department.
We have crews out now that are digging in the ground. We're installing heaters and we're doing everything that we can to get these lines thawed out.
And utilities in parts of Kansas and Missouri began rolling blackouts yesterday. Snowfall throughout the day today could pile up to more than 5 inches in Memphis and about 8 inches in the Great Lakes region. And states all along the East Coast are facing dangerous travel conditions with lots of rain and freezing temperatures. Bipartisan support is growing for a 9/11-style commission to investigate the deadly riot at the Capitol. Democratic Senator Chris Coons said a commission would prove, in his words, just how responsible former President Trump really was. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham also called for a special commission, but he said Congress also needs answers about whether top leaders on Capitol Hill were aware of the threat beforehand.
And I want to make sure that the Capitol footprint can be better defended next time. So I want to look at what Pelosi knew when she knew it, what President Trump did after the attack, and on the Senate side, was Senate leadership informed of a threat?
Graham voted to acquit Trump in last week's impeachment trial. He said there was a pre-planned element to the Capitol siege unconnected to the former president's speech on January 6th. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi voiced conditional support for the idea, but she stressed that the members who sit on the committee would be key. New daily cases of COVID-19 in the United States are down more than 20% over the past week. A three-day rolling average shows new cases have dipped below 90,000 for the first time in more than 3 months, and coronavirus vaccines have likely had a hand in that decline. 14 million Americans have now received both doses of either the Moderna or Pfizer vaccine. And while demand is still much greater than supply, CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky said Monday,
we anticipate by the end of the summer we will have enough vaccine in order to vaccinate the entire U.S. population that is eligible.
In terms of fully vaccinated residents, Alaska and West Virginia are out in front with 8% of the population receiving both doses. But distributing the shots is more challenging in crowded areas. Among highly populated states, Florida leads the way with 5% receiving both shots. Everyone arriving in the UK from countries identified as coronavirus hotspots will now have to spend 10 days in hotel quarantine. The new measure took effect on Monday. Vincent Madden is managing director of Aurora Hotels.
People will be arriving off different flights, so there's a level of the arrival being staggered. So as people arrive, we've got a waiting area for them, should we not be able to check them in straight away. But the check-in process is very quick, so we've got it down to about 2 minutes.
British citizens and residents returning from high-risk countries will have to quarantine in approved hotels near airports and seaports patrolled by security guards and will be billed for their stay. International travel is already restricted to curb spread of the virus, with Britons barred from taking foreign holidays, and people arriving from overseas are already required to show a negative coronavirus test and self-isolate in Britain. Security forces in Myanmar pointed guns at anti-coup protesters and attacked them with sticks on Monday. The assaults are part of a military crackdown on pro-democracy protesters in the country. But undeterred, activists continue to fill the streets of the nation's biggest cities. Myanmar's top political leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, remains under house arrest. And on Monday, thousands of protesters faced off with riot police and soldiers outside her NLD party headquarters in the city of Yangon. The crowd gathered to block security forces from searching the offices for NLD members. And in the city of Mandalay, protesters gathered in front of the Myanmar Economic Bank when 10 trucks full of soldiers and police arrived. They immediately began firing slingshots at protesters before attacking them with sticks. I'm Kent Covington, and straight ahead, the push for rental assistance, plus Janie B. Chaney on rejoicing in beauty. This is The World and Everything in It.
It's Tuesday, the 16th of February, 2021. So glad to have you along for today's edition of The World and Everything in It. Good morning. I'm Mary Reichard.
And I'm Nick Eicher. First up today, COVID-19 and rent.
I love your home. You pay my rent.
Since last March, most renters who miss payments cannot be evicted. That's part of an order under the government's broad authority to curb the spread of disease. This COVID order extends through March 31st.
Additionally, those who can't pay can apply for help through a rental assistance program approved by Congress last year. It includes about $25 billion for qualified tenants. And the assistance fund could soon grow. President Biden's proposed stimulus package promises another $30 billion for renters and landlords.
But really, is all of that federal rent assistance necessary? World's Sarah Schweinsberg reports.
Aidan Batar works with more than 100 refugee families in the Salt Lake City area. His agency, Catholic Community Services, helps them get settled.
When they arrive, it is our responsibility to find housing for them wherever we can find it. So,
how many of these families live in rental housing?
All of them.
Batar says the refugee community has had a difficult year. Most refugees work in service and labor-intensive jobs, making $10 to $15 an hour. Most rent a three-bedroom apartment for around $1,500 a month.
It takes at least a two income to pay for those housing. Otherwise,
but with COVID business closures and children home from school, some parents haven't been able to work as much. Batar says 40% of his refugee families have asked for rent assistance in the last year. He says the eviction moratorium has been helpful because it offers families flexibility on payments. Flexibility, but not a free pass. Even though landlords can't evict families right now, not paying rent at all would have long-term consequences.
We don't want anyone to have credit issues, right? So because landlords will report to the credit bureaus, you know, we always encourage them to have their American dream, right, to own their own homes. And so it is important that they financially become self-sufficient and also build their credit.
Batar says stimulus checks and rental assistance have helped keep families from falling too far behind. Landlords and property owners say federal money helps them, too. Bob Pinniger heads the National Apartment Association. Even with government help, Pinniger says some property owners are losing money every month because they can't evict delinquent tenants.
One of my volunteer leaders had a conversation with an operator out of Florida, and they were sharing that their uncollected rents is approaching $1 million a month. So there is distress out there.
Pinniger says while eviction moratoriums remain in place, federal rent assistance for tenants offers renters a way to not get buried in back rent. And it gives landlords the ability to collect the money they need to pay their bills.
I think that anything that we can do to try to assist is going to ensure that we maintain our rental stock on the other side of this crisis.
But despite federal help, millions of Americans are still struggling. According to data analyzed by the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, about 13 million adults, or one in five renters, are behind on rent. The center gathers that data from the Census Bureau's Household Pulse Survey. But the Census Bureau only began collecting that data after the pandemic started, so it can't be directly compared to pre-COVID rates. But other data do shed some light on how COVID conditions have affected renters. Joel Griffith is a financial regulation scholar at the Heritage Foundation. He points to numbers from the National Multifamily Housing Council. It collects information from 11 million rental units. Griffith says analysis shows pre-COVID and post-COVID rental payments haven't changed that much.
If you look at data from the National Multifamily Housing Council, it shows that 93.8% actually made their rent payments by the end of December. And that is very close to the number from December of 2019, which was close to 96%. So you're talking about roughly a 2 percentage point difference.
Griffith argues that increase in delinquent renters doesn't warrant another $30 billion in taxpayer-funded assistance.
That suggests that there's about 900,000 to 1.3 million additional people delinquent each month. Well, $30 billion in additional aid divided by roughly 1 million delinquent renters, that's about $23,000 to $33,000 over the course of 1 year for each of those delinquent units. That's a lot of money.
Joel Griffith says the rental market is ready to get back to normal. No more eviction moratoriums and no more federal spending programs.
The fact is we have an economic recovery underway, not because of increased federal funding. We have an economic recovery underway right now because large parts of the country have actually opened up.
But even after a full economic recovery, millions of Americans will still struggle to pay their rent. That was the case pre-pandemic, says Michael Tanner. He's a poverty scholar at the Cato Institute. Tanner says shutdowns have just intensified existing rental market problems.
How you disaggregate the existing problem from the COVID portion is something that statisticians can argue about. But I think there's no doubt that we had a problem before COVID with high rental costs caused by too little supply of rental units, needs to be dealt with through more building. And we have a problem that caused by COVID of people not having income in order to pay their rents. And you can argue about how the interplay between the two works, but they're both problems.
But Tanner worries government efforts to help solve rent struggles caused by COVID shutdowns will lead to bigger issues down the road.
What we want to be careful of when you have a federal program like this is it tends to live forever. What you don't want to do is have short-term interventions become a long-term program that'll end up doing more harm than good.
Reporting for World, I'm Sarah Schweinsberg.
Coming up next on The World and Everything in It, misconduct in ministry. Now a warning, this story is probably not suitable for younger listeners. So if you have some young ones nearby, you might want to hit pause right now and come back to us at a later time.
3 years before he died, well-known Christian apologist Ravi Zacharias had fended off claims of abuse made against him by a female follower, Lorianne Thompson. Zacharias accused Thompson and her husband of extortion and sued them for emotional damages.
He would later settle with the couple for an undisclosed amount and a promise not to talk about what happened. No other accusations against Zacharias surfaced until after his death from cancer in May. But then several women came forward with similar stories that revealed a pattern of inappropriate behavior. That prompted the board of his ministry to launch an investigation. RZIM released its findings last week.
Joining us now to talk about it is World's Emily Bells. She covered some of the early allegations against Ravi Zacharias last year and wrote about last week's report. Good morning, Emily.
Good morning, Mary.
Well, let's start with the evidence this report is based upon. Who were the investigators and how did they go about gathering evidence?
This all starts with two spas that Zacharias owned. And, last year there was a lone atheist lawyer named Steve Boffman who was going on and on in a YouTube channel about how Ravi Zacharias owns spas. And it all seemed a little shaky and far-fetched, but we decided to look into it and confirmed with multiple sources in our reporting over the summer that Zacharias was in the spa business, and Boffman was right. Zacharias did have back problems, so he had regular massage appointments, which some spa employees told me he used as a cover for sexual misbehavior. So all of that leads to the reports we did last fall. And then RZIM, the ministry that he founded, hired a law firm and private investigators, and they interviewed more than a dozen massage therapists in the U.S. who served him over the years. And they also got several recent mobile devices and one laptop from the ministry that he had used. And he had many devices, but the investigators were only able to get a few from the last few years. So there's really no telling what else was on the previous devices over the decades.
And what did the investigators find overall?
They found a lot for such a short period of time. The phones contained contact info for more than 200 massage therapists, and there were hundreds of photos of young women, including nude photos, as well as photos of Lorianne Thompson, who had accused him previously, and she had been dismissed by RZIM and the public, essentially. So the interviews that they did with the investigators did with therapists revealed some really horrible stuff, which I won't share in detail on here, but a number of women said that he would take advantage of them during massage appointments, and one therapist reported multiple rapes. There was another therapist who told the investigators that she remembered tying his arms down with sheets during appointments so that he wouldn't touch her.
Investigators interviewed women in the United States, but they also found evidence of alleged misconduct overseas, too. Did they look into that as well?
The investigators didn't send anyone on the ground to investigate potential abuse overseas because their main goal was just to establish if he had committed sexual misconduct, which they found plenty of evidence for just in the U.S. But he did spend a lot of his ministry overseas, and his phones revealed a lot about his overseas activities. The investigators said that he spent long stretches alone in different parts of Asia, staying at hotels where he had massage therapists come to his rooms. And he owned two apartments in a building in Bangkok, one where he stayed and one where a therapist stayed. They also found on his phone notes that were saved with suggestive phrases translated in Thai and Mandarin. He also apparently had a discretionary fund called Touch of Hope, which he used to wire money to several massage therapists, and he paid for some of their schooling and living expenses, and that was with ministry funds, which is another problem in all of this report.
Mm-hmm. Well, we mentioned Lorianne Thompson, who was really the first person to bring these accusations to light. Do we know anything more about her case?
Well, the pattern of so many other women uncovered in this investigation fit and reinforced her account of what happened with Ravi Zacharias seeking out much younger women, learning their spiritual vulnerabilities, and especially accounts of abuse in their past, and then using that to establish trust before turning the relationship sexual. And then he would warn them that if they said anything about it, they would be harming the gospel. So that's all what Thompson had said happened to her back in 2017. She had a past history of abuse from her father, and she said Zacharias took on this fatherly role with her before slowly beginning to demand sexual favors by phone. So last week in its statement, the RZIM board apologized for not believing her account and for essentially discrediting her publicly. And they acknowledged that their failure to investigate the Thompson situation was resulted in a lot of slander that they bore for some years. But Lorianne Thompson is still under a non-disclosure agreement. And the investigators said the executor of Ravi's estate had refused to release her from the NDA in any form. So this is an investigation that is validating for her, but she's not allowed to speak openly about what happened. But it is useful after, you know, being thrown under the bus as an extortionist who was trying to ruin Ravi Zacharias's reputation.
Anything in the report about what RZIM may do going forward from this?
That is an open question. They said the organization had no knowledge of the abuse. And I think that is something we have to look into, especially since the board claimed in 2017 that it had thoroughly investigated claims from Laurie Ann Thompson. There's also the question of how ministry funds were misspent to perpetuate these abuses. But they've hired some outside consultants, including victim expert Rachel Den Hollander, to review what happened and what they should do going forward. And, you know, they said they're looking at what the future of the ministry might look like. I imagine that might include downsizing or changing their name, but we'll keep following it. The UK branch has already broken away from the organization and decided to rename itself and end all ties with RZIM. And then the book publishers who put out Ravi Zacharias's books have taken them out of print. So there's a lot of things unfolding very rapidly.
Emily Bells is a senior reporter for World Magazine. You can read more of her work at WNG.org. Sad story, but thanks for joining us today, Emily.
Good to be with you, Mary.
Additional support comes from Maranatha Baptist University with online options for degree completion, mbu.edu/finish. And from the podcast, Too Busy to Flush, one couple's slightly irreverent musings on faith, food, family, and marriage. TooBusyToFlush.com.
Hey, did you hear the one about the chicken who got lost outside a Cracker Barrel?
Not a great place for a chicken.
Yeah, and this is not just any old chicken, by the way. This is a prized rooster named Peep, who is so capable he has a part in military reenactments. His owner, and I guess we could say here his commanding officer, is Thomas Ramsey. One day, Ramsey popped into the Cracker Barrel for a little lunch and left Peep in the back of his truck. So after he paid his bill and headed toward the parking lot, he discovered to his horror that Peep had gone poof. Ramsey explained to television station WBRC what he did next.
I asked them if they had any cameras in that parking lot because it looked like someone had stolen my chicken, which is kind of hard to say with a straight face.
Yeah, I get that. You know, I do. But Ramsey was up to the challenge. He hit up social media and crowdsourced a little reconnaissance on the runaway rooster. And it didn't take long for a local farmer to let him know that he'd found Peep. And so now we can say Ramsey and Rooster are reunited. And it feels so good. Hey, hey, it's the world and everything in it. Today is Tuesday, February 16th. Thank you for turning to World Radio to help start your day. Good morning. I'm Nick Eicher.
And I'm Mary Reichard. Coming next on The World and Everything in It, the Olasky Interview. Today, a conversation between World Editor-in-Chief Marvin Olasky and sociology professor Mark Regneris.
Last September, the two talked after Regneris released research examining Christian marriage around the world and some of the cultural pressures working against it.
I'd like to say I started off writing about Christian marriage and wound up making observations about the institution of marriage itself.
Well, and the institution of marriage itself, I mean, you mentioned that in 1970, 80% of Americans aged 25 to 34 were married. And by 2015, so 45 years, cut in half, 40%. I mean, that's a remarkable social change in a relatively small amount of time.
It really is. And lots of people, including Christians, kind of, they know something has changed about marriage, and they can't always kind of give voice to, like, what exactly that is, and how did it happen, and what happened?
Yeah, and you write that worldwide, it's marriage is morphing away from being a populist institution to becoming an elite, voluntary, consumption-oriented institution. You know, you own a car, maybe a house, you have some savings, then you qualify for marriage.
One of the themes that I develop is the sort of unreasonable expectations people have for marriage. And I noticed that almost everywhere. Some of that pushes people into marriage and then pushes them out. Some of that unrealistic expectations just sort of stalls people thinking that the odds don't look good for me to meet my expectations. So it's not like they have no relationships. They just don't get really serious about it and they don't move it to marriage.
Now, I hear conservatives sometimes suggesting that since no-fault divorce has been a problem, that get rid of that. But would that just make more people gun-shy to get married at all?
Yeah, no, I actually don't think people go into marriage thinking, well, I have this exit option. They're kind of aware of it, right? But I don't think people think, I'm so glad that's there and I might have to use it. I don't think people think that way. I'm a fan of getting rid of no-fault divorce, but I don't give it much thought because it's so not going to happen, right? It's an unpopular policy piece, I'll tell you that. Mm-hmm.
So we've learned that cohabitation really isn't the answer to solid long-term relationships.
What is the big threat here? Lots of Christians have married with a child on the way in the past. Fewer now than in the past because we're pretty good at contracepting. But that's private, typically speaking. Most people don't know what's going on. Cohabitation is a public thing. It's kind of a thumbing of the nose at the Christian church's vision for what marriage is. How so? If you go back to this what I call the observed model of marriage and its four key supporting expectations. Yes, it has the core, this exchange of resources between husband and wife in a sexual union. Well, they're kind of mimicking husband and wife, right? But they have the sexual union. But what they're doing is like they're pretending at these other things. It's not a total relationship. It's not comprehensive. They're not giving all. They're holding back. Fidelity may be there temporarily, but like they haven't promised a future to this person. Permanence, they've made no promise. Children, you really don't want them when you're cohabiting. So creeping visions of like the acceptability of cohabitation for Christians prior to marriage is perhaps a greater threat than their long-standing historical attractions to premarital sex. Yeah, so cohabitation is a big deal, and it's a signal of typically anxiety and uncertainty on people's parts, which is why I think, well, if you have uncertainty, marry, and you can kind of solve some of that uncertainty. But that's not how people think about this process anymore.
Well, you mentioned marriage's key traits, fidelity, permanence, children, totality. And you look at each of these, I mean, no-fault divorce, of course, ends permanence. Sexual revolution undermines fidelity, you know, as far as paternity, birth control, and so forth. So all that makes sense. And I wonder about totality.
Dietrich von Hildebrand, a theologian, talked about it. He said, the beloved person becomes the object of our thoughts, sentiments, will, hope, and longing. Yeah, that's comprehensiveness, right? It doesn't mean that you have no other relationships, but it means that marriage is a significant thing. It's not meant to be kind of like one among many sorts of relationships. That's what I mean by that.
That's Mark Rigneris talking with Marvin Olasky. To read more of their interview, we've posted a link on today's transcript at worldandeverything.org.
Thank you.
Today is Tuesday, February 16th. Good morning. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Mary Reichard.
And I'm Nick Eicher. Here's world commentator Janie B. Chaney now, pondering beauty.
At a church we attended years ago, the annual Christmas concert included singers from the local university. One of the college girls that year had been a finalist in the Miss America pageant. During dress rehearsal, an overhead mic needed adjustment, and our Miss America popped up out of her seat to do some tweaking. I had a good view from a few rows back, and I remember thinking, what a pretty girl. What a neat body. You did some good work there, God. I'm not envious of beauty, or not since high school when one of my classmates was an actual model with the coolest clothes. But that rehearsal was the first time I recall giving praise to the one who designed bodies to be beautiful. The memory came to mind with an article in Quillette titled, "The Attack on Beauty." According to the author, the body positive movement is teaching young women that the cover girl ideal is a conspiracy. Every girl is lovely just the way she is. Consider Scars to Your Beautiful, an Alessa Cara song with this refrain. And you don't have to change a thing. The world could change its heart. No scars to your beautiful. We're stars, and we're beautiful. Got that? If the world doesn't turn its head when you walk by, it's the world's problem, baby. You're a star, and don't you forget it. Now, if that message taught young girls to stand up straighter in spite of acne or bad hair, fine. But rather than confidence, they tend to display whininess, defiance, or destructive behavior because they've been told that the world should respond to them in a way it never will. Pretending everyone is a star encourages narcissism, investing in an idealized projection at the expense of one's real self. One's real self could eventually turn into a decent person if it's not obsessed with imaginary stardom. But if everyone is physically beautiful, then there's no standard of physical beauty. And we know that's not true. Even the oversized models I see in poster displays at Penny's have flawless skin and hair. In That Hideous Strength, the last volume of C.S. Lewis's space trilogy, four of the female characters are dressing for a celebratory banquet. Rather than each picking out her own gown, they collaborate in choosing for the others, and somehow the colors and styles perfectly complement each personality. The dressing room has no mirror. They are not to admire themselves, but each other. We should appreciate beauty in landscapes and flower arrangements and Miss America contestants. All the more, perhaps, because it's fleeting. The grass withers and the flowers fade. All transient beauty points to the timeless original beauty who made our eyes to observe it and our hearts to respond to it. And I think rejoicing in beauty, wherever it's found, makes us all a little more beautiful. I'm Janie B. Chaney.
Tomorrow, the World Health Organization and COVID-19. The WHO has adopted China's narrative about the origins of the deadly virus, and we'll talk about the Biden administration's response to that. And a musical love story. That and more tomorrow. I'm Nick Eicher.
And I'm Mary Reichard. The world and everything in it comes to you from World Radio. World's mission is biblically objective journalism that informs, educates, and inspires. Charm is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. I hope you'll have a great rest of the day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.